This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Inshallah, today we will carry on with the chapter of divorce, or the book of divorce, Kitab al-Talaq. And last time we went over the introduction to divorce. We talked about the ruling of divorce, and we said that the default is what? According to the majority, the default is disliked, and according to a minority that we supported last time, it is prohibited. Divorce is prohibited by default. And we talk about the details of this. And that would be the position of Imam Abu Hanifa, and one of the two positions of Imam Ahmad chosen by Ibn Taymiyyah, that divorce by default is prohibited because of the harm that it causes to the divorcee. And then, certainly sometimes divorce will be permitted, and sometimes it will be preferred, and sometimes it will be obligatory. We're talking about the divorce that is when it is not warranted or totally unwarranted. And then we talked about the types of divorce, and we said that the types of divorce are rajai and ba'in. Rajai meaning raja'a, came back, so he can bring her back, he can take her back. Ba'in means separated, mil-bayt, or separation, gapping, meaning that there is now a barrier between them. And we said that the ba'in may be baynuna sughra, which is basically, the raja'i we translated this as unfinalized, and the ba'in we translated it as finalized, but the baynuna sughra is finalized with recourse, so he can take her back with a new contract, and the baynuna kubra is finalized without recourse, he cannot take her back until she gets married to someone else and divorces him. And the baynuna al-uzma, al-akbar, is when people basically get when a husband goes through li'an with his wife, or mutual invocation of curse, public imprecation, whatever you would translate li'an as. But it is when the husband accuses his wife of zina and goes through the process of li'an, then it would be baynuna uzma. Akbar, you know, completely final, meaning there is not even recourse after she gets married to someone else, according to the stronger position. Today, inshallah, we will talk about four different major topics: competency to pronounce divorce, finalize divorce without recourse, threefold divorce, and the bid'ah divorce, which is to divorce a woman during her period, or between the periods during her purity, if there was copulation or intercourse during that interval. So the first one that we will talk about here is the competency to conduct a divorce, and you know, so that your pronouncement of divorce would count. Who's competent to do this? Imam Ibn Qudamah rahimahullah started the chapter by actually talking about the competency. So all of these things that we mentioned before was part of my introduction. But he started the chapter or the book of divorce by talking about the competency to instigate or to initiate the divorce. And he said, وَلَا يَصِحُ الطَّلَاقُ إِلَّا مِنْ زَوْجٍ مُكَلَّفٍ مُخْتَارٍ. Divorce is only valid from a legally competent and willful husband. Zawjin mukallafin muhtar. From a legally competent and willful husband. So he cannot divorce her before he marries her because he is not her husband. And don't think that this is not consequential. He would have not mentioned it, that it is a zawj, it is a husband. Everything they mention in these abridged texts is consequential, is there for a purpose. وَلَا صَحَ الطَّلَاقِ إِلَّا مِنْ زَوْجٍ مُكَلَّفٍ مُخْتَارٍ. Divorce is only valid from a legally competent and willful husband. Legally competent is my translation for the word mukallaf. And you do want to review the attachment that I have about the mukallaf. Who is the mukallaf? The mukallaf is the one who's been asked to carry a burden. It is in the passive voice. It is an adjective in the passive voice. So he is the one who has been asked to carry a burden. So kallafa means I required. Kallaftuka, I required you to do a job, a task. Usually it has to do with like a burdensome task. It would be taklif when it is a burdensome task. If I ask you to just, you know, move this a little bit to the right, that would not usually be called taklif. But taklif is where is kalafa, where is a burden involved in the process. So it's an adjective in the passive voice. It means the one who's been required to carry a burden. The burden here is the religious obligations and prohibitions, to abstain from the prohibitions and comply with injunctions, or to comply with the religious regulations in general. The beauty of the word mukallaf, by the way, sometimes we legally, legally competent, liable, because taklif means liability. If I kallaftuka, if I require the view to perform, and I have a superior position, then you're liable. And certainly Allah has a superior position over all of us. So when Allah asks of us to do something or requires of us something, then we're all responsible and subsequently liable. So that is why mukallaf is translated by many interpreters as liable or legally liable. And it does not only mean legally liable. In case you consider that part of the conditions of taklif is to be Muslim, then it would be legally liable and legally authorized. And there is some controversy over this. Are non-Muslims required to comply? Certainly the controversy comply with the details of the religious obligations, Islamic obligations. Certainly the issue does not apply to them being forced to comply in this life, because they are not forced to comply in this life. But in the sight of God, will they be held accountable for not complying with the detailed injunctions of the Sharia, or not held accountable? And there is controversy over this. Some scholars said that there is, that they are held accountable for this belief, and that is enough, so there is no accountability for anything that comes after this belief, or that is beneath this belief in the degree of evil. But some of the scholars said that they are also held accountable for قَالُوا لَنَّكُمْ مِنَ الْمُصَلِّينَ وَلَنَّكُمْ مُطَعْمِ الْمِسْكِينَ وَكُنَّا نَخُضُ مَعَ الْخَالِدِينَ وَكُنَّا نَكَذِّبُ بِيَوْمِ الدِّينَ. When they are questioned on the Day of Judgment, they say لَنَّكُمْ مِنَ الْمُصَلِّينَ, we were not of those who pray. And we did not use to feed the hungry or the poor. From a practical standpoint, if you consider them to not be mukallaf because they are not required in the dunya to perform the takalif al-shara'iyya or the religious obligations, then the word mukallaf here will mean legally competent and authorized, because they are not authorized to fast until they accept Islam. And if they fasted before they accepted Islam, the fasting will not count in the sight of God, because He had wanted them first to walk through the door, not the window. And the door is La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah. So it will not count because it is not the problem, they did not really walk through the door. So legally competent and legally authorized is the meaning of the word mukallaf. you will find various translations: liable, responsible, competent, and authorized. All of this will apply. The beauty of the definition mukallaf is that it also comes from the three-letter root of kaflam fa', which is a beautiful root because it talks about love. Kari farrajul umra'ata, the man loved his wife. So kari farrajul umra'ata, who means the man loved his wife. So why is it related? Well, what is the relationship between takalif and the burden and so on? Because when the takalif comes to you from Allah, when the request or when the demand or requirement comes to you from Allah, as a devoted worshipper, as a devout believer, you should be lovingly complying. You are lovingly taking on the burden. So you're lovingly waking up to praise Fajr. You're lovingly fasting until sunset on a long day, a long summer day. You're lovingly doing it because it is coming to you from your beloved. It's a requirement from your beloved. Your beloved is telling me, you want to please me? Do this. I would lovingly do it to please him and to draw nearer or closer to him. So he said, وَلَا يَصَحُ الطَّلَاقُ إِلَّا مِنْ زَوْجٍ مُكَلَّفٍ مُخْتَارٍ. Divorce is only valid from a legally competent and willful husband. Now, legally competent, we will now talk about whether, you know, a child may issue divorce. And according to the theme of that, Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, no. According to Imam Ahmad, and also a position, a varying position within the Hanbali Madhab, according to Imam Ahmad, he says he may issue divorce usually after age 10. Imam Ahmad has like a different category by himself for children. He uses the Sabi' al-Mumayyiz, the discerning child. He puts him in a different category. He puts the Sabi' al-Mumayyiz in a different category. He makes him even liable. But the rest of the Imams said no, the cutoff is puberty. And there is a variant report within the Hanbali Madhab that the cutoff is puberty. So just go by the vast majority and take that variant position within the Hanbali Madhab as the sort of the most acceptable position. Because it is also in agreement with the Hanafis, Malikis, and Shafi'is. You may do this within the madhab. You may take the variant position within the madhab. However, you do not report it as the stronger position in the madhab. There is a difference. When you're reporting the stronger position in the madhab, it is not you who determines the stronger position in the madhab. If you say that this sounds ultimately stronger and it is in agreement with the other madhab, that still does not make it stronger in the madhab, because you're not a verifying scholar of the madhab to report to discern between what is stronger in the madhab and what's not stronger in the madhab. So the verifying scholars within the Hanbali madhab would be two major scholars, you know, the most, you know, influential scholars of the latter generations, Ibn Qudama and Ibn Taymiyyah, not the popular Ibn Taymiyyah, his grandfather. His grandfather is an authority in the madhab. Why is that the popular Ibn Taymiyyah is not an authority in terms of his choices within the madhab, although the latter generations, they always quote him and take his position, but in terms of take his position as a variant view within the madhab, and even if they act upon it, they don't usually take his position in verifying the stronger position within the madhab, because he was liberal. Liberal within the madhab. He was not strict in following the stronger viewpoint within the madhab. He's like in Narasimha Abdul Barr in the Maliki Mazhab. They're not really sort of the strict follower that will basically spend all of their effort on verifying the stronger position within the Mazhab. So Ibn Taymiyyah will go up and look at the four Mazahib and upwards from that and look at the Sahaba and so on. So, but his grandfather was an authority because he was limited to the Mazhab. He was limited to the Mazhab. He did not practice absolute ijtihad outside of the Mazhab. He was limiting himself to the Mazhab. When he agrees with Ibn Qudamah, that's it, we're done. When he disagrees with Ibn Qudamah, usually we'll take Ibn Qudamah's position, because within the Mazhab there is no one greater than Ibn Qudamah of the latter generations. He is the author of this text manual that we are going over, Umdat al-Fiqh. So of the latter generations, there is no figure within the Mazhab that competes with Ibn Qudamah. He died in the year 620 after Hijrah. Okay, so, yes.
So the stronger opinion in the Mazhab is so the
Yaqa. So the stronger position within the Mazhab is that the discerning child's divorce counts. But this is a peculiarity of the Hanbali Mazhab. Mufradat al-Mazhab. Wahida min Mufradat al-Mazhab. One of the peculiarities of the Hanbali Mazhab. Mufradat is when one Mazhab disagrees with the three other Mazhab. So that would be Mufradat al-Mazhab. So that's the divorce of a child. But what I'm trying to tell you, if you want to remember the sort of the stronger position in the Mazhab, it counts. The stronger position overall, and the position that is consistent with the rest of the Mazhab, Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi, it doesn't count. According to Al-Madhab, yes, he can divorce. But, you know, within the Madhab also, he can consent to marriage.
If
he's a discerning child. No, 7-8 would not be considered a discerning child by Ahmad. Usually it is after 10, according to the scholars of the Madhab, that you become a discerning child. You know, a child who is, and in all honesty, he has some point, because even in science, 11 years is the cutoff for abstract operational thinking. You know, operational thinking in general starts at 7 years. That is when you can factor, basically sort out two different factors at the same time, simultaneously, which is, for instance, the length and width. If you give a child that is less than 7 years of age two different vessels, one is taller and the other one is shorter, he will always tell you the bigger one is the taller one, without considering the width. But a child that is 7 years of age will look at both length and width. And he may tell you the shorter one is the taller one, because even though it is taller, it is shorter, yet it is wider, therefore it is bigger. That is called operational thinking. Once you start to use even though, that is called operational thinking. But the operation of thinking in the physical world starts at 7 or 8 years of age. But the operation of thinking in the abstract world of values starts at age 11. So the child may then understand that even though there may be some benefits to wine, it is forbidden. Even though there may be some benefits to smoking, it is forbidden. even because the evil outweighs the good, even though there may be some benefits in gambling, it is forbidden because the evil outweighs the good. And a child that is younger than this, don't confuse them and talk to them about, you know, the benefits of gambling and the harms. And so, because it will be hard for them to digest the information and process. Anyway, so that is the child. We're done with this. Now the next one is compulsion or coercion, duress. So there is, you know, ikrah. Because here, Imam Qudama said, وَلَا أَصَحُّ طَلَاقُ الْمُكْرَهِ وَلَا أَصَحُّ طَلَاقُ الْمُكْرَهِ وَلَا زَائِلِ الْعَقْلِ إِلَّا السَّكْرَانِ. Divorce under compulsion is invalid. Also invalid is the divorce of the one without intact intellect except for the drunk. Intoxicated. Okay. Now, compulsion. So who said divorce under compulsion does not count? Yeah. So divorce under compulsion does not count. Does not count according to Maliki, Shafi'i, Hanbali. So why did Imam Abu Hanifa say it counts? Eventually he said that he pronounced divorce willfully, because even though it's under compulsion, but he knew that he's pronouncing divorce. But that's also due to some usuli difference but in all honesty, the usuli difference is not divided along those lines. You will have the Malikis and Hanafis together and the Shafi'is and Hanbalis together concerning this usuli difference. So Ibn Majah reported from Abdullah ibn Abbas that the Prophet ﷺ said, إِنَ اللَّهَ تَجَاوَزَ لِي عَنْ أُمَّتِ الْخَطَأَ وَالنِّسْيَانَ وَمُسْتَكْرِهُ عَلَيْهِ. إِنَّ اللَّهَ تَجَاوَزَ لِي عَنْ أُمَّتِ, pardoned my ummah for me, or forgave my ummah for me, for their errors, khata, wa nisyan, forgetfulness, and that which they do under compulsion, or duress. And then there is another report also with a little bit of variant wording in which the Prophet said, rufi'a an ummati khata wa nisyan, lifted off my ummah, removed from my ummah, error, forgetfulness, and things done under compulsion. But have they been really removed? And what does it mean that Allah tajawaz, that Allah pardoned? What does it mean? And has forgetfulness been removed from the ummah? Right? Forgetfulness itself has not been removed. So when the Prophet says something like this, Rufi'a عن أمتي الخطأ. رفع means removed, lifted up from my ummah, off of my ummah. الخطأ, error. Now, can I take this literally? I can't take this literally, because it's just impossible. Because the ummah makes errors, you know, that's what we do actually nowadays. So you can't really do it. So in this case, you will have to presume that there is a missing word. This is the concept of a muqtada, that it required the implication, or required missing word. So there is something required. The statement is not believable without inserting a word to correct the statement. not to correct the statement in the sense that the statement is incorrect, to correct our understanding of the statement, to straighten our understanding of the statement. If this statement cannot be understood literally, and keep in mind, people don't always use literal speech, because there is abstract speech. So Rufi'an Ummati, the Prophet, certainly did not mean that my Ummah will not be making any mistakes, will not forget. He meant what? Removed. And then the word that we will insert here to make the statement plausible, we have to insert the word. Huh? Yeah, so the asr or, you know, ism. So, asr, okay. So, everyone here is trying to be very careful with the statement of the Prophet. Trying to treat it very, very delicately. So, the Hanafis and Malikis said, if I have to insert the word to make the statement plausible, then I insert the slightest or the least that would make this statement plausible. So I will insert ism, because it is only like, you know, because what if al-haqiqa, which is the essence of error, the entire thing, error has not been lifted, then what has been lifted? Either all the consequences of error or the sin, you know, that is consequent of error, or the sin that results from this error. So, Imam Abu Hanifa and Imam Malik said, if I have to choose to insert all the consequences or the sin, I will choose the sin because it is much less than all the consequences, and it is my insertion. So I'll insert the least that would correct the statement. So here I will insert, remove off of my ummah, the sin of error. Imam Shafi'i and Imam Ahmad said, if I cannot accept the literal implication of the statement, which is that error itself has been removed, then I should come as close as possible to the literal statement. And if it is impossible that error has been removed, then at least I should say all of the consequences of error have been removed. Therefore, you do not need to do a makeup in this life, and you're not responsible for the sin in the hereafter. So they will validate what you have done. You fasted, but you, you know, drank like a sip of water in the middle of a fast day. Shafi'i and Ahmad, they would say, this is error as if it didn't exist, because all of the consequences of error should be sort of neglected, overlooked. Malik and Abu Hanifa should have both said, no, you have not sinned, because the sin has been removed, because you did this out of forgetfulness, but you need to repeat that day, because you ruined the fast, even though it was out of forgetfulness, but you still ruined it. The only thing that you will be relieved from is the sin of that act of forgetfulness, not all the consequences. But usually, the scholars, there is usually some reason to basically not follow consistently all the time your rule. So the Imam Abu Hanifa, in this particular regard of the fasting, he said, no, you don't need to repeat it either. Not because he does not believe because he believes in umum al-muqtada, as the Shafi'is and Hanbalis, which is generalizing the required implication. The required implication that must be inserted, Shafi'is and Hanbalis will generalize it, make it as big as possible. But because of the hadith, he says that this is basically opposite to my qaida, opposite to my rule or maxim, that if you, like, my rule is that the sin is removed, but not all the consequences. But I have a hadith that says, whoever eats or drinks while fasting, let him finish his fasting, because it was Allah who fed him and gave him water, or gave him drink, or quenched his thirst. So the Imam Hanifa here would say, I will do this istihsanan, out of juristic preference. Juristic preference here does not mean like sort of mere juristic choice based on nothing. He's doing the juristic preference based on the hadith. So istihsan sometimes meaning following the hadith if the hadith is counter to the qaida, the principle, the legal maxim that he follows all the time. In this particular scenario, Imam Malik switched with Imam Abu Hanifa. So Imam Abu Hanifa held true to his qaida and said that the talaq under duress will count. Imam Malik switched sides and took the position of Imam Ahmad and Imam Shafi'i, who believe in umum al-muqtada, or the generalization of the required implication. Is it? Do I need to repeat? Please tell me if I need to repeat. Really do. Because this is not like an online thing, or you're not watching a YouTube video.
Can you ask a question? Now, when you say,
three conditions, three things will exempt you from, or will relieve you from the burden of sin, according to the consensus. Sin is removed according to the consensus. The disagreement is over other consequences. Do I need to repeat, make up, no, yeah. But sin is removed by all of them. So if it is done out of error, you are not responsible. Basically, you did not know that there is a detailed discussion about this. You did not know that Fajr is in yet. So then you're forgiven for eating or drinking, since you did not know. This is error. You did not know the religious ruling itself, that something was haram, and you committed it not knowing that it was haram. That is error. You forgot and you ate. You knew everything, but you forgot and ate. That's forgetfulness. That's the second exemption. You knew and you did not forget, but you were forced. That's duress, compulsion, coercion, and that also would remove the sin by consensus. And whether or not it removes all of the consequences, then there would be a little disagreement. So Imam Hanifa here said it doesn't remove all the consequences. In this case, divorce under compulsion will count. The vast majority, or the majority, let's say, Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali said divorce under compulsion does not count. The next point, yes?
Adam and Ma'rifa is considered under Nisyan or Khata. If you don't know the...
Yes, not knowing would be considered under Khata, not under Nisyan. It's not forgetfulness, it is error. Error is twofold. It's two things. Basically, not knowing the religious ruling, or making an error in applying the religious ruling in reality. In sort of like an error في الحكم وفي الوضع. So if you make a mistake concerning the ruling, that is an error في الحكم. في الوضع, if you make a mistake concerning the reality. So you got married to a woman who's your sister. Who's your milk sister. Because someone made an error concerning her sucklings. How many times she breastfed from your milk mother. That is an error concerning the wada, or concerning the waqa, or concerning the reality. But then, if you got married to her because you believed that you need to feed, because you made an error and you thought that she should have nursed 10 times from your milk mother. Well, by agreement, that's incorrect. The most anyone talked about is 5 times. Let's say you figured, you thought it was 10 times. And then you got married to her. That is considered the error in identifying the religious ruling. So in both cases, you will be forgiven. In both cases, you'll be forgiven. Now, there's only one caveat here, is that when you embark on a religious duty, you should really learn about it. So you will not be forgiven for not learning. That you may be held accountable for. So if someone is going to Hajj, you know, you really need to learn how about it. If someone needs to perform Salah, which is everybody, they need to learn about the Salah. And then when Ramadan comes, they need to learn about fasting. And then when they have enough money to pay Zakat, they need to learn about Zakat. So they will be held accountable for their negligence. You know, about, but not for the particular error. Yes?
What would be the, is there a certain guideline for what is considered compulsion? Because, you know, some people consider like risk of financial loss to be a crop, or they have like different understandings of what it is.
And compulsion is what causes someone to befall someone into great hardship. Great hardship. And certainly there is a little bit of subjectivity in this. And is compulsion, like, let us say, you know, the scholars even talked about compulsion when someone is threatened by ruining his reputation, spreading rumors about his wife. Is that considered a compulsion? You know, no one is touching him to begin with. You know, so there is the vision of compulsion is that someone is like putting a gun to your head. Not always like this. But compulsion is basically whatever causes someone a great deal of hardship. And a man of honor may be in a great deal of hardship if someone, you know, ruined his reputation. So that would be considered compulsion in this case. So it is whatever that causes you a great deal of hardship. The next point here is divorce of the one with the impaired intellect. We're done with compulsion. The next point is divorce of the one with the impaired intellect. So we have insanity, anger, and intoxication. All of these things will impair your intellect, right? First one is insanity. You have no intellect to begin with. Because insanity is when you're completely, you know right from wrong, you don't know good from bad, harmful from beneficial. So insanity by consensus, the divorce does not count. So it's just removed. So this is another consensus. Divorce will not count here. But
he gets married by his wakil.
Yes. If she accepts or he accepts.
It won't go by.
By the guardian. So in anger. But before insanity, before we move on, foolishness is not considered insanity. The imbecile or the mentally retarded, completely mentally incompetent, is insanity. The foolish one is not insane. His divorce will count by the agreement of the four scholars. Yet he was not informed.
Or she was not informed by the person. Yeah.
A person marries someone who's insane and she does not inform him of the insanity, then he can ask for fast for revocation of the marriage, annulment. Next is anger. Anger, we said the foolish one, his divorce will count according to the form of the. Next is anger. And Imam Qudama did not, I mentioned anger in the footnotes, it's discussed in the fiqh books, but Imam Qudama did not mention anger here. Up in the text, in the main text in London. Why? Because there is the official position of the madhhab is that anger is not consequential. Be as angry as you want, your divorce will still count, and that is the position of the Malikis and Shafi'is as well. So, in anger, your divorce will count according to the Malikis, Shafi'is, and Hanbalis. So, who said your divorce will not count? Whoever is left, Hanafis. Hanafis. And a variant position within the madhab of Imam Ahmad, chosen by Ibn Taymiyyah. That's why they don't take him as like a verifier of the madhab, because he ventures out too often and takes from other madhab. So he took the Hanafi position here, that anger will be consequential and could invalidate the pronouncement of divorce, if it is substantial. Substantial anger. Then we talk about substantial, and there will be some degree of subjectivity here. The earlier scholars may have been a little bit stricter with substantiating anger. But we have some verifying scholars, like from the Hanafi madhab, like Ibn Abdin, the author of Hashiyat Ibn Abdin, one of the most authoritative books in the Hanafi madhab. He said that the anger that will impair your intellect, not that you are not cognizant of what you're saying or aware of what you're saying, but you're not aware of the consequences. Your anger impaired your intellect to the point where you are not aware of the consequences of what you're saying.
Extreme anger.
Huh?
Extreme anger.
It's extreme anger. But it is not the extreme anger that some of the earlier scholars of the Hanafi madhab have talked about, where you don't know the difference between the male and female, or the sky and the earth. So it is not where you are just completely obstructed mentally. There is a little bit of awareness remaining, but Ibn Abidin, rahimahullah, said, your intellect is impaired enough to not understand, fully appreciate the consequences of your pronouncement of divorce. Ibn al-Qayyim added another, basically, qualification for this anger. He said that you would be immediately regretful once your anger abates. You become immediately regretful. Like you just cool off a little bit, And then you say to yourself, what have I done? What did I say? That is an indication that your anger was substantial enough to affect the validity of the pronouncement. Yes?
If the extreme level of anger invalidates a divorce, then what would the criminal claim's position be on an extreme level of anger that causes somebody to murder someone?
Extreme level of anger that causes someone to murder somebody or to basically destroy their property, will not exempt anyone from the punishment by consensus. Will not. However, if it was provoked, it may lighten the punishment. If it was provoked, it may lighten the punishment. But you're responsible because you're told to not get angry. However, divorcing your wife is different from killing or hurting, wounding somebody or destroying their property. Their body, their life, their property is sacred in the law. So your anger will not be consequential here. But your marriage, according to the scholars, is different from someone else's property or someone else's body. But yes, consensus, the anger will not be consequential. But if it was provoked, it may be consequential to the punishment. La talaqa wa la ataqa fi irlaq is the other proof this minority group cited. It's a minority group. You know, particularly when you take the medium anger that Ibn Abdin and Ibn Qayyim are talking about, if you take that medium anger, that would not make you unaware, but not fully cognizant of the consequences, it's a minority group. Even within the Hanafi madhhab, not everybody will listen, will agree about this medium anger. Because in the Hanafi madhhab, yes, anger does invalidate the divorce, but it is the extreme anger that was described by the earlier scholars. But that medium anger is a minority position. Yet what may support the minority position here, certainly the, you know, contemporary scholars always like to mention the intent of the legislator and the objectives of the Sharia as a consequential factor. That does not mean they're wrong, but it's basically quandary. It's not like easy to invoke the objectives of Sharia in the face of the detailed pieces of evidence. And you have to be very careful when you do this, because you will have to be observant of both. Your eyes are fixed on the objectives of Sharia, but your way to the objectives of Sharia is guarded by the milestones of the detailed evidences. So you're surrounding yourself by the detailed evidences, you're not usurping, violating them, but you are sort of observant, watchful of the objectives of the Sharia. Is it clear? So once you ignore one of the two, once you're not watchful of the objectives of Sharia, and you drown in the detailed evidences and the technicalities, then you will be in error. Once you ignore the detailed evidences and you're only watchful of the objectives of Sharia, then it will be basically a completely unregulated process, because the objectives of Sharia are not. Objectives of Sharia are agreed upon even by non-Muslims. So if you talk to non-Muslims, you know, sacredness of life, property, absolutely. The roadmap to achieving or realizing the objectives of Sharia is delineated by those milestones on the signs in the way, the detailed evidence that would protect you from deviation to the right or to the left. Anyway, so the lata lata, wada atapa, ti and la. Is one of the strongest proofs in support of the minority position of Ibn Abdin and Ibn Qayyim, that substantial anger that is short of making you completely unaware would still affect the validity of your pronouncement. La talaqa, there is no talaq. Wala ataqa, and there is no manumission, emancipation. Fi atlaq, in a state of irlaq. What is irlaq? Some people say irlaq would mean infuriation. Abu Dawud said that. Some people would say irlaq means coercion, compulsion. Infuriation does sound acceptable because irlaq comes from the three-letter root, ghain, ghayn, lam, qaf, which means what? Closing or shutting. Closing. Close. And anger can close, veil, obstruct your intellect. Right? So it makes sense that irlaq would also mean anger that reaches the point of obstructing, even partially, your intellect. So you want to remember what is the position of the madhab? Anger is inconsequential. You want to know what is the fatwa of contemporary scholars, most contemporary scholars? Anger is consequential. Because most contemporary scholars take Ibn Qayyim's and Ibn Abdin's position concerning anger. Yes?
Is this a hadith?
It's a hadith. This is a hadith. It has a little bit of controversy over the authenticity. However, Ibn Hajar and Ibn al-Mulaqqin both consider that Hassan or sound. So it has like two issues. One, the authenticity, the establishment of transmission. But some of the scholars of Hadith, most notable scholars of Hadith, consider that Hassan or sound. And it does seem to be Hassan. Acceptable. And then the other issue with the hadith is the implication of the word irlaq, because they disagreed over the meaning of the word irlaq. But if you accept, going back to the root of the word, if you accept that infuriation, you know, substantial anger, and I'm using substantial, you know, intentionally versus extreme, because according to Ibn Abdin and Ibn Qayyim, it is substantial and not just extreme, because extreme is when you become unaware. Your anger causes you to be almost unconscious. And that happens. Some people can get angry to the point where they become just completely aware. They're not here.
That's criminals.
Criminals?
That's what distinguishes criminals from...
No, not necessarily. No. Some people actually get angry, they frost, you know, their mouth. It they become really not here. Then they may eventually get into trouble with the law, but you know, not necessarily they're criminals.
Did they apply this to other acts?
When we said, I just said to who was asked that question.
No, we just spoke about murder, but
murder, theft, just destruction of property, anything inconsequential. Anger is inconsequential once you usurp the rights of others.
If somebody takes a cold from their extreme anger, does he have to pay a kafara in that case to get out of it? Or
if you're unaware of what you're saying, then no. Because part of the taklif is shara'i, part of the shara'i taklif. Keep in mind, if a child ruined the property of somebody, the child will be responsible even though he's not liable in the sight of God in the hereafter. But there is something else that we're looking at here. The sacredness of people's property. So a child goes and ruins someone's property, let's not say a child. Are cattle reliable in the sight of God in the day of judgment? No. But if the cattle go and ruin the property, the owner of the cattle will be liable in certain cases. I mean, if it was expected of them to keep them from people's property and so on, then he will be liable, because we're not looking at the action of the cattle, we're looking at the sacredness of property. And that is why, you know, people will have to watch their steps. In a society that is regulated, where people's property is sacred, people need to be watchful. If you have cattle, make sure that you keep them, you know, in their stables, particularly at night. If you have children, make sure that your kids are not wild, going out, ruining people's properties. Yes?
Will the sin of kufur be consequential or during anger?
Unless it has to do with people's property and people's rights, anything that is between you and God, anger, extreme anger that will make you unaware, will make that inconsequential. Everything, because part of the conditions of taklif is sound intellect. If you don't have that sound intellect, you're not responsible. If the anger was extreme enough to basically obstruct you from understanding what you're saying, you don't know what you're saying, then you should not be responsible for what you're saying.
You know, like the curse of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is that considered foolishness, or would that be considered?
Did he know what he's saying at the time he said it?
I mean,
did he know what he said at the time he said it? If he knew what he said, he is liable. If he did not know what he said, he is not liable. That's about one, yes.
Now, just to make it easy, Talaq al-Ghadban, Yata and Maliki Shafi'i Ahmed, La Yata Hanafi and Ibn Taymiyyah, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Next is, but like I said, the Hanafis, the earlier Hanafis, will only consider extreme anger. But the latter Hanafis, particularly from Ibn Abdina and then after Ibn Abdin, they will consider substantial anger that would not make you completely unaware, but would make you unaware of the consequences.
So the Hanafis two opinions. The latter opinion, yes. Extreme yaqa.
The latter opinion, even substantial, would the latter opinion of the Hanafis is that substantial anger will invalidate the pronouncement, so it will not count. Yes? That's good. Yeah. Okay. The problem is that because I'm mentioning all of the different positions, that people get confused. Do you want the position of the madhab of Hanbali, or you want my choice? Okay. So So if you want the contemporary scholars, and certainly even if I say most of the contemporary scholars, then I count them all, I did not. That's my assessment. All of this stuff is subjective. But a lot of the contemporary scholars that I have come across, that I have seen, would consider substantial anger that would impair your judgment, not necessarily completely obstruct it. So you're still aware of what you said. When you said you're divorced, you were aware that you're saying to your wife you are divorced. But your anger was substantial enough that you were not really cognizant, aware, conscious of all the consequences. So Ibn Abdin said that, and Ibn Qayyim added another qualification. He said, this angry person, once his anger abates, he will say, what did I say? He will be extremely regretful. What have I done? And he will regret once his anger cools off or abates. So it will not count based on this minority position that became a majority position in our times because a lot of people are foolish and getting angry too often and divorcing their wives. Now, the next point Imam Qudama raises here. Okay, so he said that even, he said except the one who's drunk, which is intoxication. So according to the Hanafis, the Malikis, the Shafi'is, and the Hanbalis, if you're drunk and you pronounce divorce, they will count it against you. They'll count it. Hanafis, Malikis, Shafi'is, and Hanbalis. Who's left? Nobody. But there is a variant position in the Hanbali madhab. Small a, chosen by Ibn Taymiyyah, rahimahullah, that it will not count. That it will not count. And so why is the disagreement to begin with? Why are they disagreeing? The majority said that the one who gets drunk is still legally liable, because thus it is the agreement of the Sahaba to hold him accountable, or they did in fact hold him accountable for murder and theft. So they're saying that this means that the Sahaba are agreeing that he's accountable. So his divorce will count. Because he was not deprived of his intellect, he himself impaired it. So we will not exempt him from his actions because it is him or her who impaired their intellect.
This is about that one who is drunk.
Drunk, intoxicated. So this very position in the Hanbali madhab, they will also cite another work that is not authentic from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. كل طلاق جائز إلا طلاق المعتوب المغلوب على العقل. Every طلاق will count except the طلاق of the mentally incompetent who has been deprived of his intellect. But this is, the report, the hadith itself is not sahih. So here, this very position in the Hanbali madhab chosen by Ibn Taymiyyah, how do they rebuttal this? This seems to be a very formidable argument. The Sahaba agreed to hold him accountable. How does Ibn Taymiyyah rebuttal this? He said that I agree with the Sahaba's agreement. I hold him accountable for murder and theft. But he will raise, the the sort of the point of distinction between murder and theft on one end and divorce on the other end. So he will hold him accountable for murder and theft, but he will not hold him accountable for divorce, because he would say murder and theft are different from divorce. Because in murder and theft, you have already usurped someone else's property or sacredness of their life, their body, their property. So you will be held accountable. Everybody is agreeing on this. This is a consensus. No one is arguing. But he said divorce is unlike this. And then Uthman radiallahu anhu, who has been Munzir reported, Uthman did not count the divorce of the intoxicated. Ibn al-Munzir said that there is no contestant of the Sahaba of Uthman's position. So to Ibn al-Munzir, he wants to say the consensus of the Sahaba is that the divorce of the one intoxicated does not count. Yes, they all held them accountable for murder and theft. But because Uthman said that Uthman did not count the divorce of the one who was intoxicated, and that position of Uthman, we don't have a report of contending Sahabis who contested that position. Ibn Munzir wants to say the consensus of the Sahaba is that the divorce of the one intoxicated will not count. And that would be Ibn Taymiyyah's sort of principal support in this regard. In addition to that, the principle, which is you need to have the sound intellect to be liable and responsible. And the fact that you incurred it, not impaired it, will make you liable if you usurped other people's property. But not will not make you liable, will not make you liable if you did not usurp other people's property concerning your marriage. So if someone gets intoxicated and then he makes a pronouncement of kufr, disbelief, is he a disbeliever? No, he is not a disbeliever, because he did not know what he was saying. The fact that he, you know, committed the sin of drinking wine should not just throw him into disbelief. He's a sinner. But, you know, it doesn't get him into disbelief because he was unaware of what he said. That would be also another supportive or corroborative evidence for him. Now, yes.
Which at that time or and then interest will affect this, for example, if she's suffering from drinking, or it's only what he is saying. Is it saving the family will come to which she is suffering and the family is suffering?
Yeah, if she wants to get rid of him, if he gets drunk and she wants to get rid of him, she will not have a difficulty getting rid of him in the Sharia court.
Like if he
said,
no, I'm saying if he divorced her, would we have
according to the family situation, or like in terms of what should she do?
Harm in, no, the harm is that the family is taking, for example, if he gets drunk and he divorced her, and she does not need, or she does not want
to get back with him.
Yeah, is the counted or?
Well, it depends on the method of the judge. If the judge believes that divorce of the intoxicated person does not count, then he will not count it.
Yes.
Then the wife could ask for divorce and a dar because of the harm.
No, I mean, choosing the method would be according to the family or...
According to the judge, not according to the family. the judge. So the then Imam Qudam rahimahullah said, وَيَمْلِكُ الْحُرُّ ثَلَاثَ تَطْلِيقَاتِ وَالْعَبْدُ اثْنَتَيْنِ سَوَاءٌ كَانَ تَحْتَهُ حُرَّ أَوْ أَمَا. Just, okay. All right. Yeah, I said talaq al-hazl was al-hazl or talaq al-hazl, which was to pronounce divorce jokingly, it will count according to the form of zahir, will count according to the form of zahir, and they cite a hadith in which the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Thalathun hazbuhunna jidd, wajidduhunna jidd, al-nikah wa-talaq wa-raja." Certainly there are various reports, and some of the reports al-ataq, which is many mentioned. So in some report it is marriage, divorce, and raja'a, taking her back, and in some reports ataq is the third one, many mentioned. And that's the agreement of the form of zahib. And in this case, he said it jokingly, so there is no intent of divorce, but we will hold him accountable because he was aware, he knew what he's saying, he was willful, he was not coerced, so he's not going to play with divorce, and so he will be held accountable.
So is that divorce
valid? Valid. According to the form of that. No. Yes.
So they also, if I remember correctly, I'm going to say it. The fact is, if a person is angry and he does feel slave, they do make him angry.
Yeah. Here they will do this out of juristic preference. لتشوف الشارع إلى الحرية. If he's angry and he frees his slave, they will not make anger consequential. It is called لتشوف الشارع إلى الحرية. تشوف الشارع إلى الحرية means the keenness of the legislator on manumission, emancipation, liberation of the slaves. Because it is one of the objectives of the Sharia to emancipate the slaves, they will take any emancipation, even if someone did it jokingly, someone did it while he's angry, they will not say anger here is consequential. They will say it's consequential in divorce, because it is the objective of the Sharia to keep the families intact. Right? Versus the objective of the Sharia to liberate the slaves. So since the Shara wants the slaves liberated, and the legislator, the intent of Allah, is to free and emancipate the slaves, then we will always lean on the side of freeing the slaves, and we will not exempt one from his emancipation if he did it. Unless he is completely, completely angry, the extreme anger where he's not completely, where he is completely obstructed, then some of the scholars will say it doesn't count. The emancipation will not count. But this is a minority position, very small minority position. The vast majority would count. ويملك الحر ثلاثة تطليقات والعبد اثنتين سواء كان تحته حر أو أما. The free man is entitled to three divorces and the slave is entitled only to two, whether the wife is free or not. Anyway, you know the free man is entitled to three divorces. That is the finalized divorce without recourse, that is a bainun al-kubra. So why did Allah give the free man three divorces only? Why can't you just take her back? She wants to come back. You want to take her back. Why can't you just take her back? Two reasons that we can comprehend, with two comprehensible wisdoms, is that they used to abuse the women in the past And during the waiting period, they would take them back. So they divorced them, and then they let them hang out for a little while, and before the waiting period ends, they take them back. And then they divorce them, and then they would let them just like spend a little time in the waiting period, and then they would take them back. So Allah put an end to this by giving the free man 3 divorces only, after which he can't take her back. The other benefit in this legislation, or the other wisdom in that legislation, is sometimes both of them are blind. And Allah wanted to show them the way out of their, quagmire that they are in. So it's a failed marriage. And sometimes people like their miserable reality. They fear from the unknown. They fear from breaking away from their miserable reality. They would take abuse, they would take, a lot of things, and just to keep the status quo. So Allah is telling them, is forcing them to move away from their failed past. It didn't work out. Your marriage is not working out. So you ought to look for, like, another path or another life partner. Because you both are not mixing well. So that's the reason why you have those 3 chances. Next, Imam al-Qudama said, فَمَدَ اسْتَوْفَ عَدَدَ طَلَاقِهِ لَمْ تَحِلَّ لَهُ حَتَّى تَنْكِحَ زَوْجًا غَيْرَهُ نِكَاحًا صَحِيحًا وَيَطَأَهَا لِقَوْلِ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ لِمْرَأَةِ رِفَاعَ لَعَلَّكِ تُرِيدِينَ أَنْ تَرْجِعِي إِلَى رِفَاعَ لَا حَتَّى تَذُوقِي عُسَيْلَتَهُ يَذُوقَ عُسَيْلَتَكِ. Whoever uses the number of divorces he is entitled to, his wife will not thereafter be marriageable to him until she marries another man and they have intercourse. This is because of the statement of the Messenger of Allah صلى الله عليه وسلم to the wife of Rifa'a, maybe you want to go back to Rifa'a. Nay, you can't until you enjoy sex with your new husband and he enjoys sex with you. So basically, because people always look for loopholes in the law. And Allah knew that people, once you make a legislation, people start to look for loopholes. Okay, so you want us to get married? We will get married, formally married, but we will not consummate the marriage, and then I'll go back to my husband. Then it becomes like a loophole in the law, and people circumvent the law by this. So the Prophet said, no, until you have sex. Which means that it has to be a bona fide marriage. It is not only paper marriage. Huh? Front.
But if they close the door, it's still going to count as a consummation, right?
No.
They actually have to engage in.
Yes, because it has to be a real marriage. If they come out after they close the door and they said we're done, then they'll be sinners. But in the court of law, closing the door will count as intercourse. But they would be sinners because they married, they did not marry. They did not mean to marry. Their marriage was a front, it was not free. So the Prophet is saying it has to be a real marriage. You must have married her to marry her, not to make her permissible for her previous husband. And that, we will discuss this later in another chapter, the issue of al-muhallad, the one who makes the woman permissible for the previous husband. This is coming in a different chapter, so let us defer it to that chapter. So now we're talking about the composite threefold divorce. Because after he said this, Imam Qudama said, وَلَا يَحِلُّ جَمْعُ الثَّلَاثِ. It is impermissible to combine the 3 divorces in one. It's impermissible to combine the three divorces in one. And I'm not gonna stop, but if you guys are tired, anyone who wants to walk around, to stretch, to get like coffee from the back, do this. No, I don't really need coffee. I don't want coffee. But do this on an individual basis, because we're not breaking. But please feel free to do it on an individual basis. So the finalized divorce without recourse, we were done with this, okay? We said the finalized divorce is the Beilun al Kubra. And this happens after the third divorce. We're done with all of this, and this is what we have left, only two issues. The threefold divorce and the bid'ah divorce. There are two only, but they're... So the threefold divorce, Imam Qudama said, وَلَا يَحِلُّ جَمْعُ الثَّلَاثِ. It is impermissible to combine the three. So you don't say to your wife, أَنْتِ طَلَقْ بِالثَّلَاثِ. Or you don't say to your wife, أَنْتِ طَلَقْ طَلَقْ طَلَقْ. You don't combine them in the same session. It is impermissible. Permissible, impermissible, according to?
So this count?
Huh? Counting is another issue that we will come to now. Threefold divorce. Talat bithalath. Okay. So impermissible, like as haram. According to Abu Hanifa, Malik, and Ahmad, it is halal, meaning permissible, according to Shafi'i, and another report in the Hanbali Madhab, A2. Okay. But let us say that the majority said it is impermissible. Yes. But it will still be permissible. Makruh is a category of permissible. It's not forbidden. But they did not all say makruh, by the way. But Ibn Qudamah and Mughni said permissible and makruh, both positions. As the variant view. So, impermissible, permissible. Keep in mind that talaq in itself is makruh. So, it would not be like such a move. Not the difference. Impermissible and permissible. That is as far as permissibility.
But what does permissible mean? Because when the person said,
he would have committed a sin.
Okay. But he
according to the condition of divorce, he said out of anger, and he just wants her to understand and hear it. You know, 3 times, 4 times. You know, sometimes they go on. So it is not permissible, yeah?
It is
impermissible. It's haram for him to do it. Now, does it count?
Yes.
As three. Okay, so threefold divorce counts as three counts as one. So who said counts as three? Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, Hanbali. Who said counts as one? You see, because he that's why he got a lot of heat during this time, because it was just like, to them, it was like, to his contemporaries, what's this guy doing now? So, and like a lot of choices outside of the form of that. But keep in mind, if you collect them all together, you will not find them too many. And most of them are in this area of divorce. Most of his choices outside of the Madhahib have been in this area of divorce. Why? Because in his time, it was just like sort of rampant. The people are divorcing three times and then they're getting the muhallil, and some of them were observing the rules and letting the muhallil actually sleep with their wives. And then some of them were not observing the rules and letting the muhallil just close the door and try to circumvent the rules. And it was, Ibn al-Qayyim even said that we have become the laughing stock of the nations because of this dilemma of divorce. So someone is angry, divorces his wife three times, they have four kids together, or during that time, probably 14 kids. And then instantaneously, they can't get back together. So, yeah.
The practice during the
Islamic Prophet was that okay, well, the practice, here is the issue. When we say that the way of the Prophet was that it was once, we are sort of invalidating the rationale. We won't say this, but within the context of presenting the different arguments. So we will quote the hadith, we will cite the hadith, we will explain it, but you will have to also be considerate of the position of the former then. Absolutely. The Rasul is on top of all of them. However, they are on top of me. That's the issue. So I am still getting to the Rasul through some medium here. Through a link, right? Of Mujtahid Imams. It's just like when the other day, when I was talking to someone about like some issue. Oh, never mind. It's, it would be too much branching off here. But okay. Counts as three, counts as one. Now, so for Ibn Taymiyyah to come up with this position during a time, sort of 8th century after Hijrah, a position that's counter to the agreement of the four Madhahib, when the Taqlid of the four Madhahib was at its peak, when he got a lot of heat, he was put in prison, some people went as far as calling him kafir, and all of that stuff. But was Ibn Taymiyyah the first one to come up with that position? Absolutely not. And had he been the first one to come up with this position, then he's an innovator. He would have been an innovator. But he was not the first one to come up with this position. Imam Hafiz ibn Hajar, rahimahullah, he marveled in Fath al-Bari at Ibn al-Tin's claim that there is no controversy over this issue. And Hafiz ibn Hajar mentions to rebuttal Ibn al-Tin's claim that there is no controversy over this issue, Ibn al-Hajar mentioned the people who contested that position, which is that three will count as three. So Ibn al-Hajar said that the people who contested that position are not irrelevant at all, or not insignificant. They are Ali ibn Abi Talib, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, Abd al-Rahman ibn Awf, Al-Zubayr ibn al-Awwam, Ibn Abbas, Tawus, Ata, several Maliki scholars like Muhammad ibn Baqi ibn Makhlad, Muhammad ibn Abd al-Salam al-Khushani, and others. Ibn Ashur, which is a contemporary, Ibn Hajar said that even though Ibn Hajar supports the majority position, but just out of academic fairness, he was saying that even though I support the majority position, this minority position is not the invention of Ibn Taymiyyah. It has been the position of several Sahaba and Tabi'in and Imams and followers of the Madhahib before him. Ibn Ashur, a supporter of the minority position, a great Maliki scholar, a great contemporary Maliki scholar, contemporary meaning, you know, he died in the 60s of last century. So, a great contemporary Maliki scholar, he mentioned in his book, Al-Tahrir wa-Tarwiyah, or what, his tafsir book, some other names of Maliki, and he's a supporter of this position, minority position. And many of the contemporary scholars are supporters of the minority position of Ibn Taymiyyah. Even the people who read Ibn Taymiyyah the most, they still take that position. Because the price tag of the other position is just like huge social, on a social level. So Ibn Ashur mentions here that Muhammad ibn Zinba' and Asbar ibn al-Hubab and Ahmad ibn al-Mughis al-Tulaytili have all upheld that minority position. That three would count as one. So if you can test the position of the four madhahib, you better come up with a formidable argument that will be based on the text of Revelation, the position of the earlier generations, and you have to be qualified to undertake the gigantic task of refuting a position that is upheld by the four madhahib. It is believed by most of the contemporary scholars that the conditions were met, that Ibn Taymiyyah was qualified to undertake the gigantic task, that his position was not unfounded in terms of the text of Revelation, and that it was not unprecedented or unprecedented that some people preceded him to upholding this position of the Sahaba and the Tabi'in and other generations. Therefore, many of the laws in Muslim countries nowadays uphold that minority position of Ibn Taymiyyah. But because why do we say it is the minority position of Ibn Taymiyyah? Why do people always blame, you know, the permissibility of music on Ibn Hazm, even though I don't agree with Ibn Hazm? But why are we always blaming Ibn Hazm for permitting music? Because he is the one who basically constructed the sort of the most complete argument on behalf of that position. So that is, it does not mean that Ibn Hazm is the only one in the history of Islamic scholarship that said music is permissible. It means that Ibn Hazm put it all together and he was the spokesman of that position because he put the argument of that position all together. The same applies to Ibn Taymiyyah here. When we say this is Ibn Taymiyyah's position, we're not saying, look at what Ibn Hajar, look at the names. So Ibn Taymiyyah is greater, or Ali ibn Abi Talib, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, Abdullah ibn Abbas, Abdurrahman ibn Awf, Zubayr ibn Awam. It's a no-brainer. But why are we putting in the position of Ibn Taymiyyah? Because he was the one who put together the argument, defended it, and always got imprisoned for it and got, you know, sort of disreputed for it. Okay, the argument of the other imams, okay, if we try to look at the arguments now, we have the ongoing practice from the time of Umar radiallahu anhu is that three divorces count as three. This is the ongoing practice from the time of Umar radiallahu anhu. The four imams would say, Umar would have not invented this of his own. Umar must have taken this from the Prophet. So that's one argument. Second argument, the imams, because they have many arguments, and you know, I did not discuss all of their arguments, because discussing all arguments here would certainly be beyond the scope of the book. But the second argument is the hadith of Rukana, or the story of Rukana. And this story of Rukana has been used by the majority position, and it has been used by the minority position, because there are variations in the story of Rukana. The majority position cites the variant report where Rukana came to the Prophet ﷺ, and he had divorced his wife Al-Batta, a final divorce. And then the Prophet asked him, did you mean one divorce or three divorces? And Rukana said that he meant one divorce. So the Prophet basically gave her back to him. The majority would say, this is quite obvious, the Prophet inquired whether it was one or three divorces. He gave her back to him when he said that it was one divorce. The problem with the story of Rukana is that it has been reported also that Rukana came to the Prophet ﷺ and he had divorced his wife three times, and the Prophet said to him, this is only one divorce. Therefore, the very story of Rukana comes with conflicting reports. And it would be prudent in this case to drop the story of Rukana out of the discussion.
Is this really contradictory? It doesn't seem to be contradictory. It just seems that one narration is more complete than the other. Because the second one needs to count. It's only called by one. It has to be based on the other narration that he asked. Did you mean one or three? When he said one, he said that it is one. Take care of that.
How do you know? Well, let me repeat this.
So one narration. Shorter than the other.
There are not two narrations. There are several narrations. But if you put all the narrations together, it is extremely hard to reconcile between them. You know, some scholars would have the wit of making it plausible. But plausible does not necessarily mean probable. So you can make a plausible argument on behalf of the reconciliation, but it would still not be a probable argument. In all honesty, I find it difficult to reconcile all of the reports of the story of Rukana. When you have the reporters yattaribun, report with inconsistency, one story, it is safe to say, drop the story out of the discourse. Take it out, because there is some inconsistency here. Look for something else. So looking for something else, the minority position, and some of the contemporary scholars who supported, like Ibn Ashur, for instance, who supported the minority position of Taymiyyah that they would count as one, Ibn Ashur in particular mentions this because he's a mufassir, so he has like an emphasis on the Quran. He mentions the ayah in which Allah said, "Talaqu marratan, fa imsakun bima'ruf aw tasrihun bi'ihsan." Divorce is twice, then fa is then, which to Ibn Ashur means these are not happening simultaneously. There are steps here. One comes after another and separated from the other. So talaqu marratan, fa imsakun bima'ruf aw tasrihun bi'ihsan. And then later on down the page, فَإِنْ طَلَّقَهَا فَلَا تَحِلُّ لَهُ مِنْ بَعْدُ حَتَّى تَنْكِحَ زَوْجًا غَيْرَهُ فَإِنْ طَلَّقَهَا فَلَا جُنَاحَ عَلَيْهِمَا أَنْ يَتَرَاجَعَا إِنْ ظَنَّا أَنْ يُقِيمَا حُدُودَ اللَّهِ. Then later on Allah said, and if he then divorces her, that's after the second time, then she will not be able, if he then divorces her after the second time, then she will not be able to return together, until she marries another woman. And then if he divorces her after she got married and she came back to him, and he divorces her, then they may be able to reunite, because he will have three more divorces. After she marries, then they will start the three anew. Because in this case, it is hoped that she married someone, a real marriage, and failed in her real second marriage, so that she may behave, or he may behave, when they come back together. Like, there would have been a period of separation. She wised up, she got married to another man, the marriage failed. She figured that there must be something wrong that I'm doing on my end that is making my marriages fail. So then they would be given three chances, start anew. Or he may wise up, because he will say, you know, my wife went out and got married. It's not a pleasant experience for any man. So, but at any rate, so now Ashur is saying that this ayah is clear, that divorce does not happen simultaneously. It happens once after another. And he argues that this is the intent of the legislator, to give three chances. If you lose all of your three chances at some moment of anger, you have not been given three chances. Because people get angry, and then you pronounce the three combined divorces in a moment of anger, it takes away the purpose of the legislation, which is allowing you three distinct chances. Now, the next, you know, the bomb, the elephant in the room that Ibn Taymiyyah used is an authentic hadith reported by Muslim from Abdullah ibn Abbas. كان طلاق على عهد رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم وأبي بكر وصدري وسنتين من عهد عمر الثلاث طلاق الثلاث واحدة فقال عمر بن الخطاب إن الناس قد استعجلوا في أمر كان قد كان لهم فيه أنا فلو أمضيناه عليهم فأمضاه. So this is the strongest argument for the minority position of Ibn Taymiyyah. It is a hadith that is reported by Muslim, hard to refute in terms of transmission, and hard to refute in terms of clarity as well. Even though the best one who put an argument together to refute the implication of the hadith would be Ibn Hajar in Fath al-Bari, under the title of those who permitted the three combined divorce, because he was Shafi'i. The Shafi'is are the ones who permitted the three combined divorce. So in Fath al-Bari, under this title, he put like a solid argument on behalf of the majority position against this hadith, or against our understanding of this hadith. Ibn Hajar would never defy a hadith. Ibn Hajar is more committed to the Sunnah than all of us here combined. You know, that would even slight Ibn Hajar. Who are we combined? So, but Ibn Hajar is Ibn Hajar, so he would never defy a hadith, but it's against our understanding of the hadith, our deduction from the hadith. So you can review it. But the hadith is pretty clear, and it is pretty verifiable in terms of transmission. Abbas said that the talaq, the three talaqs, threefold divorce, used to count as one during the time of the Prophet ﷺ and the time of Umar, Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, and the first 2 years of the Khilafah, or Caliphate of Umar radiallahu anhu. Then Umar said, people are making haste concerning a matter in which they should have shown deliberation, or regarding which they should have shown deliberation. So let us count it against them. Let us enforce it on them so that they behave and stop doing this. So Umar is saying that they are doing something impermissible. They are divorcing their wives at a combined state of divorce. They are making a combined as a pronouncement of divorce or threefold combined divorce. and this is impermissible and this is haram. Since they're doing this haram, let's just enforce it on them so that they behave and refrain. So let's enforce it on them. This, whether Omar was right or wrong, this is a different discussion. Because Omar is not infallible like the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Omar is the greatest of this Ummah after the Prophet and Abu Bakr. Omar is in Mulham, the one who's inspired. Omar is the one who would have deserved to be a Prophet after the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, had there been Prophets after the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Yet, by consensus of all Muslim scholars, Omar is not infallible. Because there is only one person that is infallible of this final ummah, which is the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. So whether it was right or wrong, but it was done in goodwill. Omar wanted to make them refrain. So it was an executive order. An executive order, not a tashri'a. There is a difference between the executive order and the tashri'a. So Omar did not make the tashri'a here, but he made an executive order as a form of punishment for people who violated the law. He punished them by separating them from their wives. So that particular hadith would be in Ibn Taymiyyah's sort of principal support. He gets called to the court because of almost sort of heresy, which is countering the position of the four mazhab. And then he would say, but Muslim reported from Abdullah ibn Abbas, but you would still look good, right? Because you're reporting a hadith in Muslim that's agreed upon, and then the clarity of the hadith is also quite obvious. And then when Abdullah ibn Abbas, who's Abdullah ibn Abbas, says that it used to count as one during the time of the Prophet and Abu Bakr in the first 2 years of the Caliphate of Omar, you would still look good. Even though you would wind up in prison, but at least you have made a good argument.
Is there a difference between the way he's saying it or the Prophet and Muhammad and the Prophet, or the Is there a difference in that sentence or the way he's saying it, or it's all new or gold?
Divorce. If he really meant to, if he wanted to emphasize the first divorce, basically reiterate that I mean you are divorced, I'm not instigating the second divorce, you are talaq, I want you to hear it, then it would count as one. But this is also still a minority position. All of these are minority. According to the majority, it's done, over. But there is a minority position that distinguishes between emphasis and instigation of new divorce. Okay. So we're done with this part, right? Is it clear? Do you have questions pertaining to this particular part? Most of the contemporary scholars, those who were fans of Ibn Taymiyyah, those who were not fans of Ibn Taymiyyah, will take his position. In even, contemporary laws in Muslim countries, because like I said, the consequence of taking the majority position is huge socially for the Muslim family. Some sister have a question? Or a brother?
I have a problem understanding the hadith here. At the time of Rasulullah, Abu Bakr, 2 years of Umar, طلاق الثلاث واحدة, meaning the three divorces count as one, correct? So how this is interpreted as the three is three, that he, how come it became an executive order? It seems like it's obvious here. If he does it, then it's wahid. Then he says in the continuation that people rushed in it, so I'm by now alive. So it's not like I'm creating a new legislation here. The legislation is already exists. I'm just enforcing it. At least this is my understanding. I'm a bit confused in how the interpretation of this became an executive order, because it clearly says talaq of thalat wahid. It's not
so,
like,
so hadith says that three divorces counted as one.
So like,
but Omar in the nasaq al-istadaru fi amrin takkara lahum fihi, people are making haste concerning the matter. So people are making three divorces. So let us enforce the three divorces on them, not the one. Let us enforce it as they pronounce it. Three as three, not three as one.
This is supposedly a wrongdoing of people. This is not a legislation. The legislation is the three count.
So we will punish them because they are doing wrong, they are doing something impermissible. We will punish them and count it.
Yeah, I understand this part, but I'm saying then this is a new legislation. This is not an executive order to enforce an existing legislation.
No, I didn't say it's an executive order to enforce an existing legislation. It's an executive order to punish the people for their wicked conduct, not to enforce an existing legislation. If you believe in the minority position, so we're not disqualifying the majority position as, no. If you want to look at the two positions with complete fairness, because it is also beyond the scope of our discussion today, but if you want to look at it with balance, read Ibn Hajar's chapter on those who permitted the threefold divorce, in Fath al-Bari. Bab man abah talaq al-thalas in Fath al-Bari. So he basically puts together the strongest argument on behalf of the majority position. And in this way, you will have a balanced view or exposure to both positions. Let's finish this quickly, the final one, so that we would have finished Kitab al-Talaq. Divorce during the menstrual period. Divorce during the menstrual period is haram by agreement. There is no controversy here like the three combined divorce. In the three combined divorce, we said it is haram according to the majority, but the Shafi'is and one position in the Hanbali madhab said it is permissible. But in the case of bid'ah divorce, to divorce a woman during her period or to divorce a woman in her time of purity after copulation or intercourse is haram. Purity after copulation. Divorcing a woman in her period or in her time of purity after copulation, after they had sexual relations, is haram. According to whom? Consensus. Okay, so having known that, does it count? That's the interesting discussion. Does it count? Because if it's haram or done, haram, keep in mind, this is pertinent to certain women, women who have periods. Women who do not have periods, it's not pertinent to them. Women who are not pregnant, because women who are pregnant, it is not pertinent to them. Women who are in a consummated marriage. Women who are only contracted, not in a consummated marriage, this is not pertinent to them. A premenarchial or postmenstrual woman, or a pregnant woman, or a contracted wife that has not consummated the marriage, are out of this discussion. Their divorce will be halal and will count at any time. Will be halal if it is halal, if it is warranted. And pre-menarchial, menarche is what? Is when a woman has her period, starts to have her period. Pre is before. Post-menopausal is, menopause is when a woman stops having her period. Post means after. So pre-menarchial, post-menopausal, pregnant, and contracted woman who has not consummated her marriage, those do not have a sunnah and a bid'ah divorce. They can be divorced at any time. So if it is warranted. Right? So you don't have to basically watch for the time when you're divorcing one of those women. It is the woman who's having periods and not pregnant and consummated her marriage where you need to watch when you're divorcing her. So that sunnah divorce, Allah said, Ya ayyuha nabiyyu idha talaqtum an-nisaa fatalliquhunna li'iddatihin. O you Prophet, when you Muslims divorce women, divorce them for the commencement of their iddah. Which was explained by the Prophet to mean divorce them either in a state of purity where you have not touched them, or in a state of purity where you have not touched them. That's the only thing. But don't divorce them in a state of purity where you have touched them, had intercourse, or if they are having their period. One of the wisdoms that we can understand from this legislation, or about this legislation, that if you divorce her in her period, and you're counting the waiting period by the periods, then you will not count that period. So you will prolong her waiting period, which may constitute a degree of hardship, some level of hardship for the woman. So you're not counting this waiting period in which you divorced her. So you're not counting, so you're prolonging the period. So if you divorce her in this period, you're not gonna count this period, right? So you're gonna count from next period. That is prolonging your waiting period. So that is haram by agreement. Now, does it count or not count? Okay, this is another discussion. So bid'ah divorce, counts, does not count. Who said counts? Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, Hanbali. Who said does not count? And it is not only Ibn Taymiyyah, but once again, he is the one who put together. So sort of Ibn Taymiyyah was on a campaign to narrow down the divorce, the concept of divorce, just like invalidate as much divorces as he can to prevent the consequences. So why does Ibn Taymiyyah, you know, and Ibn al-Qayyim, some Maliki scholars as well, and of the contemporary scholars you have Shawkani and Sarani and Siddiq Hasan Khan and Ahmad Shakir and Ibn Baz, and you know, this is the position of the Shia and the Khawarij as well. So outside of Ahlul Sunnah, it is the position of all of the factions outside of Ahlul Sunnah. They don't count it. They don't count the bid'ah divorce. The Shia, the Imamites, don't count the bid'ah divorce. Ja'far al-Sadiq did not count it. And the Imamites followed Ja'far al-Sadiq and not counting it. So it was not really once again Ibn Taymiyyah's invention, but he is sort of responsible for the position of, like, Ibn Hazm is made responsible for permitting music, because again he is the one who put together the argument, or the most complete argument on behalf of that position, and defended it, and got, you know, interrogated for it, and so on. Two things here, two issues here, and that is basically the crux of this matter. There is one hadith and one fiqhi principle. The one hadith is the hadith of Abdullah ibn Umar when he divorced his wife when she was in her period, and the Prophet Umar went to the Prophet, told them Abdullah ibn Umar did this, and the Prophet said to him, مُرْهُ فَلْيُرَاجِعَهَا, or order him to take her back. حَتَّى تَطْهُرْ ثُمَّ تَحِيدْ ثُمَّ تَطْهُرْ ثُمَّ إِنْ شَاءَ طَلَّقَهَا. So tell him to take her back until she becomes pure, and then she has a period, and then she becomes pure, and then if he still insists, then he will divorce her. So far, you can't use this hadith to say it counts or it does not count. The problem is, this hadith had variant reports. In some of those variant reports, the Prophet said, وَلَمْ يَعُدْهَا شَيْئًا. Or the narrator said about the Prophet, and he did not count it as anything. And another hadith, the narrator said that the Prophet ﷺ said, وَلَيْسَ ذَلِكَ بِشَيْءٍ. This is nothing. لَمْ يَعُدْهَا شَيْئًا did not count it as anything. Or when he says, لَيْسَ ذَلِكَ بِشَيْءٍ, this is nothing. What does it mean? So Ibn Taymiyyah would say it means that he did not count it as a divorce. He did not count it as a valid divorce. The majority would say, no, it does not mean that. It means that he did not count it as something good. لَمْ يَعُدْهَا شَيْئًا صَالِحًا. Ibn Taymiyyah would rebuttal this, you know, like a big rebuttal on usuli basis, that whenever the Prophet does not count it as anything, you know, as something, then the closest to not counting it altogether or denying the haqiqa of the divorce is to deny the validity, because that validity is closest to the haqiqa, the essence. If I can't deny, if the Prophet ﷺ says, لا صلاتة لمن لا لا صلاتة لا صلاتة لا صلاتة بلا طهور. There is no salah without purification, without purity. Then, if I can't say that there is no, the essence of salah, I can't deny, negate the essence of salah because he stood up and he did this and so on, I will negate the validity of the salah. I will at least negate the validity of the salah and say this salah is invalid. So that's the strongest position here. Yeah. The other scholars said that this very hadith of Abdullah ibn Umar had variant reports. And in some reports it said, حُسِبَتْ عَلَيْهِ اَعْتَدَّ بِهَا جَعَلَهَا وَاحِدًا. It said in some reports that it was counted against him, that he counted it as one in other reports. Then we will get into the discussion of which reports sound stronger than others. And that's a whole different discussion. Yet, in all honesty, just like that story of Rukana, this hadith, there is so much inconsistency in reporting this hadith. Take it out of the picture and get to some other part of the discourse. The other part of the discourse is where Ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah said, "Nahyu yaqtadi al-fasad." We agree, we all agree that this is prohibited, that it's haram to do this bid'ah divorce. And a nahi yaqtadi al-fasad, the prohibition implies invalidity, because this is a qa'da fiqhiyya. However, the prohibition does not imply invalidity all the time. If the prohibition pertains to the essence of the matter, essence, or pillars, arkan, or conditions of validity, shurut sahha, or inseparable attributes الصفات اللازمة, then in this case the prohibition will indicate validity, invalidity. The prohibition will indicate in this case invalidity, such as selling and pork, invalid transaction, because the essence of the transaction is forbidden. Pork as a commodity is not a commodity. And then, you know, praying, selling during the time of Juma also is invalid. Then they disagree over certain things, because fasting on the day of Eid, invalid or valid? The invalid according to the majority. Valid will be according to the Hanafis. Although they say it is wrong, they will validate it, because they say that the prohibition of fasting on the day of Eid is extraneous to the fasting, its essence, its pillars, its conditions of validity. But the Jumhur would say, but it is the prohibition, it pertains to an inseparable attribute. It is the Prophet forbade the very fasting on the day of Eid. You cannot separate that this is the day of Eid from fasting. You're fasting on the day in which it is prohibited to fast. So the Jumhur would say fasting on the day of Eid is invalid, because the prohibition here is pertains to an inseparable attribute or a sifa nazil. All in all, I believe that the majority position is stronger. The majority position is stronger, that the talaq will count, because the prohibition here is truly not a prohibition of the essence, that concerning the essence of talaq, pillars of talaq, conditions of validity of talaq, or the inseparable attributes of talaq. It is a prohibition of something extraneous to talaq. When do you issue it is extraneous to talaq. That would be it for this particular book, the Book of Divorce. And inshallah, next week we will go over the chapter on explicit and implicit divorce, Babu Sarih al-Talaq wa Kinayatihi, and we'll talk about texting divorces and writing a divorce and like a legal document or court and stuff like this, and divorce that is basically implied and not explicit. Zakum wa khairan, subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika, ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.